This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The Facebook fizzle.
What went wrong with the company's IPO?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. It's Monday, May 21st.
Coming up, a conversation with billionaire energy investor T. Boone Pickens.
Orthodox Jews versus the Internet.
And what Google's executive chairman wants you to spend 1 hour a day doing.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
At the market open this morning, Facebook stock was down about 12% after Friday's initial public offering. And that IPO didn't go exactly as planned. The start was delayed, computer systems locked up, and NASDAQ executives are promising to fix the problems. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Not our finest hour is how NASDAQ CEO described the IPO computer malfunction. Friday morning, lots of Facebook investors sent in cancellation or modification orders, which caused the software to reset. Buy and sell orders didn't go through for hours. At Tangent Capital Partners, Christopher Whalen says the issue is the alphabet soup of U.S. stock markets is decentralized and fragmented.
And they're all taped together with a patchwork network that changes every day. So you're going to have problems.
NASDAQ's electronic plumbing has been criticized for not having enough human backup. But don't expect a return to the days of shouting traders, says finance professor Michael Goldstein at Babson College.
In almost everything we're doing in life now, we have more electrons doing the work than people. That ship has sailed.
NASDAQ reportedly will redesign its IPO system. U.S. regulators are looking into Friday's glitch. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We've all heard about the cost of health care for seniors going up, but a report out this morning finds the amount of money spent on health care for children is growing even faster. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the details.
The report is from a new healthcare think tank called the Healthcare Cost Institute. It analyzed about 3 billion health insurance claims from 2010. Carnegie Mellon health economist Martin Gaynor chairs the institute. The report found that healthcare spending for kids under 18 is rising almost 1.5 times faster than spending on the 55 to 64 age group. Why? Gaynor has some theories.
We have more kids who have diabetes, for example. It could be that we have more kids with asthma. It could be teen pregnancies. There could be a number of other things.
But although spending increased the fastest for the 18 and unders, we still shell out the most health care dollars on their parents and grandparents. Austin Fracht is a health economist at Boston University.
At age 65, you're going to spend twice as much as you spent when you were, say, 45.
Gaynor says that's why the bump up in healthcare costs for the very young is so troubling, because they'll be spending even more when they're 65. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Some of the biggest losers in business over the last several months have been natural gas companies. Despite high fuel prices, natural gas has not taken off as a major energy alternative, at least not as much as billionaire investor T. Boone Pickens had hoped. He was one of the biggest boosters of the industry, and now he has dumped his natural gas stocks altogether. T. Boone Pickens joins us now from Dallas. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
You recently got out of Chesapeake Energy, a big natural gas producer. Why did you do that?
Because natural gas has been a disaster. It'll be great at some point, but today it's trading at $2.37, and it's pretty cheap.
Well, people are going to look at that and they'll say, you know, he was really hot on natural gas, then he got out of it, just like he was big on wind and that didn't turn out to be so good. What do you think is going wrong here? Why are these alternative fuels not as popular as you think they'll be?
Well, the fuels, you're not going to move into wind until natural gas gets up $6. Okay, so wind's on the shelf. And you got natural gas, they're moving in the fuel about as fast as they can go to it. It's $1.50, $2 a gallon cheaper than diesel, and you have the truck switching over to it.
But even with oil as high as it is and gas prices as high as they are, it does seem like Americans are sticking with the good old-fashioned stuff that they know.
Well, Americans now, I'm talking about truckers and you're talking about you. I mean, your car, you're not going to switch to natural gas till you have an infrastructure that'll accommodate it.
Right.
Now, with truckers, not so. Trucker's not going to ever buy a truck unless he has a place to fuel it. And those are going into Pilot Flying J truck stops. They're building 100 of them right now. So that's happening very fast.
Well, you've been in the business for decades now. Did you?
Decades, for sure.
Did you think, you know, decades ago that in 2012 we would still be addicted to foreign oil the way that we were back in the 70s?
Well, no, I didn't think that would be the case, but we have just sat there because of cheap gasoline over the years. We have no energy plan for the country. It's pitiful. We're using 25% of all the oil produced in the world every day.
Well, do you think that Washington is ever going to get an energy policy together that you will think is a good one?
Whether we do or we don't, I've had about all this I want to fool with, but...
What do you mean you've had all this you want to fool with?
Oh, I mean, Washington deal is a great amount of it. So much time is wasted. Very little is accomplished. It is absolutely the saddest place to go and try to get something done.
Do you know who you're going to be voting for this year?
Oh, I am. Let me say this. I've never voted for a Democrat in my life for president. So,
all right.
If that'll help you.
Okay. Billionaire investor T. Boone Pickens, thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. President Obama will be with world leaders in Chicago today after meetings at Camp David over the weekend. The big takeaway from those meetings is that there should be more of a focus on growth rather than austerity as Europe grapples with another flare-up in the debt crisis.
Julia Coronado is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Julia, do you think that everyone from this G8 meeting is on the same page now that growth rather than austerity is the way to go for Europe?
Well, unfortunately, it's not quite so simple. I think we can all agree we want growth, but countries like Spain are finding it hard to fund the deficits that would help them boost growth. So they would need some outside help. And few people are raising their hands to provide it. And of course, the worry is that the lack of confidence in countries like Spain is going to spread to the banking system that holds a lot of Spanish debt.
Well, and that's one of the things that we always talk about as the biggest fear for the United States as all of this European crisis unravels, which is that if there's a problem with the banks, that could actually really cause problems over here.
That's exactly right. I mean, that was the liquidity crisis of 2008. When worries about growth turn into a banking run, we're talking about a recession. So we've seen some flight of deposits out of countries like Greece and Spain. So far, it's actually surprising that it hasn't been more pronounced. But of course, these things can be so fragile and can be, once they get underway, very hard to stop. So that really is the key worry right now.
Well, are the Europeans ready to deal with any banking crisis?
Well, there's some talk, of course. They're aware of this risk. They're thinking about possible solutions, including a European-wide bank deposit insurance scheme, much like we have with the FDIC, that would help investors and depositors have more confidence in the banking system. Very complicated when you're talking about 17 countries
right.
Coming to an agreement.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
For more on Europe's banks, let's bring in the BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin. Hello, Steve.
Good morning to you.
Steve, what tools does the Eurozone have to mitigate any possible banking crisis that may be emerging here?
It has lots of tools. The question is whether it chooses to use them. I mean, what the ECB, the European equivalent of the Fed, could do would be to guarantee the bank deposits of the Central Bank of Greece, for example. But Germany's against any collective underwriting of the debt of the individual banks. Largely, Germany fears the amount to which its taxpayers would be vulnerable.
What about at the level of the individual depositor? In the United States, the government forces the banking system to provide deposit insurance. Does Europe have that?
Different bits of Europe do, but the individual banking regulations within different countries do vary. At the moment, we don't quite have a run on the banks in Greece. We have, I don't know, a slow run, and it's been called a bank jog. People are going to ATMs and taking out a little bit more of their money. And companies are, it seems, taking their funds out of euros each night and then putting them back in for business the next morning. And the danger is with that kind of thing is the moment people think a bank run is on the way, then that jog becomes a gallop.
Indeed. The BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
A cash lifeline for the internet company Yahoo. It's selling half its stake in Alibaba. That's China's biggest online commerce company. Alibaba's Chinese founder is buying it back for more than $7 billion. There is also some Chinese ownership coming to a theater near you. America's second largest movie theater chain, AMC, now based in Missouri, is getting purchased by one of China's biggest real estate development and movie theater companies. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
The Dalian Wanda Group bought AMC for $2.6 billion. Wanda runs 86 movie theaters in China. AMC runs 346 in the U.S. James McGregor, author of 1 Billion Customers, says in pure real estate developer fashion, this deal for Wanda is all about expansion.
These guys got money and they probably got vision. And they're going to go to America and learn how to do it and get best practices and make good money along the way.
Chinese box office sales last year were around $2 billion, making it the third biggest market after the U.S. and Japan. From the looks of it, there's nowhere to go but up. That's because going to the movies in China is an upscale affair. Customers typically buy reserved seats in luxurious theaters, and tickets aren't cheap. A ticket to see the 3D epic Avatar in China, for example, costs three times what it cost in the U.S. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
It seems like we live in an age when big-budget summer movies do well. They do very well. And when they crash and burn, well, you remember John Carter earlier this year? This past weekend, Battleship failed to meet expectations while the Avengers managed to keep raking in the cash.
Here to talk with us for today's Midday Extra is Gitesh Pandya, editor of BoxOfficeGuru.com. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Let me first ask you why Battleship might not have done as well as expected.
Well, I think a number of reasons. First and foremost, it's the product. You know, people go to the movies because of the product. Is it a good film? Does it look like a good film? And from day one with the marketing campaign, this film looked as if it was Transformers in the ocean. Not that that's a bad thing, but, you know, people have had that over and over again. This one does not have Michael Bay involved at all. So it looked like a sort of a cheap ripoff of something people have seen before. And then the whole disconnect between the title and the board game, you know, it's something which younger audiences are not all that familiar with. Older people are. But if you look at the trailers and the commercials, you really don't see any kind of connection between that board game and this alien adventure film. So that's part of the problem. The reviews were not very good. And certainly one of the biggest problems was the fact that you had this juggernaut, the Avengers, in the marketplace. So coming 2 weeks after Avengers, if you're an audience member who likes action films and big budget special effects, you've got two options. You're going to go with Avengers because A, it's the better film, and B, it's got tremendous buzz. All of your friends are recommending it. So if you haven't seen it already, you're going to go to it or see it a second time. And Battleship, competition-wise, just could not compete.
Now, it seems like maybe an obvious thing, but I think we always need a bit of a reminder about this, that a big marketing budget and a strong brand, Battleship the board game, aren't all that you need. I mean, the movie itself cannot stink. I mean, it has to be an okay movie underneath there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the content is king and the film itself has to be good or at least look good. You can kind of fool audiences for one weekend, with a great marketing campaign. But still, at the bottom, at the end of the day, you need to have a good film. Now, you know, I didn't think Battleship was a bad film. I think that it's a fine movie for a specific audience, a very lowbrow action audience. When you want to just check your brain at the door and have some mindless explosions and things blowing up, you go to see Battleship. It delivers on that front. But when you've got Avengers out there, the choice is so simple.
But I think one of the interesting things is that we've had now the last few months, we had John Carter, huge flop. Everybody said, uh-oh, Disney's in trouble. Then
right.
Not long after that, the Avengers come out, and it's just way beyond expectations. Everybody, oh, Disney's fine now. And then out comes Battleship, and it's sort of just fizzles. And I just wonder, is there a trend here? Can we say anything general about what's going on in Hollywood right now, or is it just each individual movie does as it does?
Yeah, I don't think there's a trend here. There's a lot of big-budget flops that we've had in the past, especially in action movie in that genre. Those are typically the most expensive films. And I think that moviegoers are getting more choosy and more picky. And so mediocre doesn't sell anymore. 10 years ago, a mediocre action film with lots of explosions and, you know, mindless kind of entertainment could sell. But today, there are so many more entertainment options. People have almost everything on demand right at their fingertips. So if you want someone to leave the house, leave their mobile device, go to that thing called a movie theater and pay money, you better have something really good. You better have the big artillery. And Battleship had the artillery on screen, but it really wasn't something that would draw people out. It wasn't a must-see film, wasn't a brand that people had to go for, like The Hunger Games or The Avengers. Battleship, okay, fine, it's a board game. I played it as a kid, certainly, but do I want to see a movie based on it? Not really. You need to have more at the table. For a movie with a budget this big, over $200 million, to have an opening of about $25 million, that's almost unheard of to be that low. Typically, a movie of that size, of that cost, is going to open with at least 30 or 40 million, if not much, much higher. And here's another thing. They programmed it into very expensive real estate. The weekend before Memorial Day weekend is a high-profile weekend. A lot of big franchises get plugged into there because you have a chance to make a lot of money in the first week and then also the second week. So it's very valuable real estate. Hmm. They put Battleship into this. And this is the first time in 14 years that a movie on this particular weekend failed to break $35 million. You always see huge openings on this particular weekend, and this year Hollywood failed at it.
Gitesh Pandya, editor of BoxOfficeGuru.com, thank you very much for this.
Great, thanks a lot.
There's a parking spot coming on the market in New York City this year. It could be yours for $1 million. The single-car indoor spot, said to be the most expensive ever for New York, is on East 11th Street, convenient to Union and Washington Squares. The New York Post quotes the real estate people saying the parking space could appeal to the camera-shy business executive. If it's just about going incognito, I've always found that simple nose glasses and a fedora work wonders. It's a lot cheaper.
You know, David, when I lived in New York, that intersection down there at like 11th and 5th or 10th and 5th was, I always, every time I walked by there, I thought, oh, you know what? One day I want to be able to live in one of these houses. And it was only after a little while I realized that's probably the most expensive possible intersection in New York City.
Well, you'll have to stop working for a place that has .org at the end of its internet site. That'll be someday.
In New York last night, tens of thousands of Orthodox Jews gathered at Citi Field, that's where the Mets play, to discuss the ups and downs of the internet. Isaac Jamal was among those on hand.
The internet today, if you don't have a filter on it, not even for the Jewish world, for the secular world and for kids, it's very, very hard to watch it and to overcome all the situations that come up online.
So what do the Orthodox rabbis who convened the event at Citi Field want from the internet? Here's Marketplace's Shireen Meraji.
Everyone got a glossy magazine with tips on how to, as the event spokesperson Eitan Kobri puts it, separate the technological wheat from the chaff.
What hath technology wrought in our lives, to our brains, to our hearts, to our ethics, to our relationships?
Kobri says the web hath wrought addictions to pornography and online gambling. He says every computer in an Orthodox Jewish home should have some sort of web filter, at the very minimum. And Kobri is not a fan of social networking sites like Facebook.
It's leaving a trail of disruption of the fabric of human life.
But tweeter and blogger Rabbi Eliyahu Fink says social media helps stretch his message way beyond the synagogue.
It's really a great opportunity, and I think it should not be missed.
He agrees that there's a right and wrong way to use the internet. Rabbi Fink even supports web filters. He's just not convinced that summoning thousands to Citi Field was the best use of time and resources. I'm Shireen Meraji for Marketplace.
When it comes to food stamps, not always buying food are created equal. As part of our coverage of wealth and poverty issues, I'll explain.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
Did you know groceries bought online can't be paid for with food stamps? The U.S. Agriculture Department just announced it'll pilot a program with one New York grocery store to allow a small number of food stamp recipients to buy groceries online, but Congress would have to make this nationwide. Jason Ackerman is the CEO of the grocery store that's piloting the program, Fresh Direct. Good morning, Mr. Ackerman.
Good morning, David.
So you're calling for what? Food stamp recipients to be able to buy groceries online?
That's correct.
Why?
Well, currently, food stamps, you cannot transact online. The EBT program is not modernized. And so if you're a food stamp recipient, you can't buy online.
I have to tell you, though, that buying groceries online seems like an upscale sort of thing. You think it could work for this a different market segment like this?
We do. In fact, if you look at a lot of the food stamp recipients are working moms. And they're trying to balance the life of raising their kids and working. And I think that convenience is valuable and eating nutritiously is valuable. So we do think that there's a marketplace for it.
Now, many lower-income people will have trouble with fast internet access. Could that be a barrier here?
It's a bit of a misnomer that low-income areas do not have internet access. And I think it's getting stronger. It's certainly not the entire segment of the population. But no, we feel pretty good that the access is there.
What motivates you here? Is this about being able to have even more customers, bigger markets?
In a small way, but I think largely Fresh Directs really believes that it's part of our corporate obligation to be able to create access of nutritious foods for all income levels. And I think when you look at the lower income parts of New York, there is a real obesity problem and diabetes problem. And if we can be a part of the solution by creating access of quality nutritious foods, which is lacking in those areas, then we really want to do our part.
And you're not just saying that. I mean, there is evidence, right, that shows that in some tough neighborhoods, you can't just easily walk to a place to find fresh produce.
No, you can't. You know, you can maybe find it at the local bodega, but it's likely also not as fresh, and it can quite often be very expensive. And if you go into the Bronx, for example, and talk to the community, they really have a hard time accessing fresh foods, and this could make it more accessible for everybody.
You're going to put these local bodegas out of business?
Well, I think there's room in the market for everybody, but hopefully people will eat more nutritiously.
Jason Ackerman, CEO of Fresh Direct, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
And finally, too, some advice from Google's executive chairman, Eric Schmidt. He spoke at Boston University's commencement yesterday and told graduates to spend 1 hour a day not looking at a mobile phone or a computer screen. Just 1 hour, have a real conversation, he said, adding, quote, "Some of you are probably tweeting this speech right now." And indeed, David, they were. There were tweets going even from the dean of students during the speech.
Well, they know how to multitask.
Indeed. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.